Sunday night edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. It was an anticlimactic Game 7 for everyone but Raptors fans as they destroy a Heat team that finally ran out of gas due to injuries. 116-89, 30-11 in the final quarter as Kyle Lowry went absolutely nuts, scoring 35 points on 25 shooting possessions, 9 assists, 3 offensive rebounds, just a completely insane performance, finally worthy of kind of the player that he had been all year. So we'll talk about that. Then we're going to do an off-season preview of the Miami Heat and then preview Golden State and Oklahoma City. And Danny is joining me to do all of that.
Yeah, and to build on Kyle Lowry, I think that what was also notable is that this came on the heels of a very strong Game 6 when he scored 36 points. And so it kind of fuels the narrative that he is at least to some degree back.
Yeah, a big part of him being back was the fact that the Heat had no one to protect the basket after Game 3. And he basically started to kick it into high gear the moment Whiteside left the series. And now he was able to get into the lane. I mean, when Whiteside was in there, he wasn't even attempting shots at the rim. You know, he doesn't shoot an amazing percentage there even still, but he was 4 out of 7 at the rim in this game. And then he also was hitting his three-pointer. I mean, he was 5 of 7 on threes, and every single one of his makes was a really tough three-point shot. You know, nothing wide open. And when you can shoot the ball like that, which he has at times in his career, he has at times this year, he became that special player again.
Yeah, and the other guy who I think we should single out for praise is Bismack Biyombo. He was really good, and his offensive rebounding effort helped fuel them to a 20-7 offensive rebounding advantage.
Yeah, he had 6. Patrick Patterson had 7. That's got to be a career high in offensive rebounds for him, for sure. DeRozan had 4, although they may have all been off of his own misses, which is very DeRozan-like. DeRozan still struggled. He had 28 points, but it took him 32 shooting possessions to do it, and he also turned it over 3 times. I was going to say this till later, but since we're talking about him, you know, he's played on what's been some pretty good offenses these last 3 years, despite his own inefficiency at times. Other times he can be efficient because he gets to the free throw line enough. But they had a very efficient offensive game in this one. Is it possible that he still contributes to a good offense despite going 12 out of 29 from the field in this game?
Sure. Wasn't there a piece a couple of years ago about how Carmelo Anthony kind of did the same thing, about how having one guy take a lot of inefficient shots can actually lead to better shots for everyone else?
Well, in theory, I think that works. If you're really like, okay, every time we run the shot clock down below 7, we're throwing it to this guy. And, you know, once the shot clock gets below 7, 12 out of 29, that's not bad. And then everyone else can take the efficient shots. But it doesn't work that way because they throw it to him with 13 on the shot clock. And then he just dribbles around and dribbles around and dribbles around and ends up taking, you know, can't really get by guys. He'll try to just back down. Doesn't have a ton of wiggle. And maybe he'll get fouled. But, you know, he again, was missing his free throws in this one. And so, I don't think that holds a lot of water. I mean, I think, you know, I was sort of bringing it up as devil's advocate.
I don't believe it either.
Yeah, well, I figured you're not the biggest DeRozan supporter yourself. Let's talk a little bit more about Biyombo, though, because he played 41 minutes in this one. And basically, whenever he was in this series, the Heat really struggled to score. And he also was able to finish inside at the rim. You know, that's the big thing that he struggles with, is catching the ball. And then, you know, if he has contact before he jumps, he has trouble kind of, you know, having any kind of touch. But especially with Lowry setting him up time and again, especially in transition, Biyombo, just his energy level was unbelievable. He was running the floor every time, contesting shots on the defensive end, contesting every rebound for a Heat team that, despite the fact that they, they just got out-rebounded so badly, so it's hard to run in those situations, but the Heat just weren't really able to run, and so you might as well contest. And they ended up with 20 offensive rebounds for Toronto and 23 defensive rebounds for Miami. Their lack of size finally caught up to them, but, you know, they just didn't have any good bigs. You know, it wasn't like this was bad player usage by Spo.
Exactly. It was not a situation where he got out-coached or anything. He just got out unhealthy, or got out healthied, I guess would be the way to put it. And Biyombo did a really nice job for, you know, in the situation he was put in. He has made himself, in my opinion, of course, it's hard to know because it's such a counterfactual, but I feel like he's made himself a lot of money during these last couple games.
I was talking about this. Larry Kuhn was in town, and we were working on some of the stuff for Sports Business Classroom, so we watched the game together, and we were talking about where would Charlotte have been? How could this series have changed if Charlotte just makes Biombo a qualifying offer and brings him back at, you know, $4 million? They probably win that series against the Heat if they have Biombo.
They're probably higher up in the seeding anyway. You know, if they had him for the whole year.
Just let me go on. Enough of your facts. Yeah, that may.
But
well
but
be
yeah,
true.
I mean he would have been a big
or Clifford could have just played Kaminsky over him the whole year anyway.
Yeah,
who knows?
Then we would have had so much material though. But yeah, I think that Biombo.
Yeah, and then the Raps obviously don't win the series either. You know, without him, he was fantastic.
Yeah, and I think they might have even fallen off the two line because of the time that he helped keep them when Valanciunas was hurt during the regular season. I mean that really helped keep them afloat. And there's no chance.
Part of those Lowry plus bench units that you know won them a ton of games, and it was fitting that was the unit that just broke it open like crazy. Lowry, Corey Joseph, Terrence Ross, Damari Carroll, who is obviously a starter but came in with the bench guys, and then Biombo. That was the unit that finally did it. I mean, I thought Spo's gambit to go with Winslow at center worked really well in game six, and that was, he had to go to it again, but I think the Raptors finally were ready for that. And the reason that Miami was still able to defend in game six is because not having any rim protection doesn't matter as much when you can actually just keep them out of the paint. And so they were switching everything and causing problems. That's happened the same thing that happened on the end of game five. And the Raptors were able to get stops. They were able to get out in transition. They were able to get offensive rebounds. They were able to get into the paint when Josh McRoberts was in the game and they weren't switching as much. And Lowry was hitting his jumper, so they had to push up on him, and then he was able to get to the rim too. So for all of that, that's how Toronto really was able to have just an incredibly efficient offensive game in this one.
And you don't always see this kind of a discrepancy, actually. You very rarely do. But one of the tenets of rebounding is just making sure that you get more opportunities to score than your opponents. Toronto attempted 13 more shots from the field. And so you go, sometimes that leads to because of a free throw discrepancy or something like that. So they had 13 more shots in the field. They also had 20 more free throws. So it's hard to lose when you have that kind of a circumstance.
Yeah, and 9 out of 20 from 3 as well. And the free throws, yeah, I would say the whistles favored Toronto a little bit, but not to the point where it was going to make up, a 26-point difference.
Agreed.
So, I figured we said it once Whiteside went out and when Valanciunas went out, that it was going to be advantage Toronto. Frankly, they should have finished him off faster than this, having a 2-1 lead after game three to actually let Miami win two more games in this series, as shorthanded as they were, was kind of sad, I thought. But whatever, they advanced in seven games, exactly as a certain person on this podcast predicted, I believe.
Yeah, and if Whiteside had stayed healthy, I probably would have been right. But you can't.
Yeah, I think that's probably right because they just could not score really very well when he was in there.
But that's the way it goes. That's part of the prediction game.
Yeah, that totally changed the series.
And to the victor goes the spoils of probably losing to Cleveland.
Yeah, I was asked to participate in a survey today that assigned a percent chance of winning the series to Toronto. I went with 15%. Does that seem low or high to you?
My first thought when you just mentioned it was 20, but that's close enough.
Yeah, we're really kind of on the margins there, and we'll probably, maybe we'll get back to this series, we'll see how long everything else takes, or we'll just do it tomorrow night to preview Toronto and Cleveland. Anything else that you wanted to say about the Heat season and their effort in these playoffs?
I think they've done a really nice job of really dealing with the complications that befell them. I mean, you think about Whiteside, of course, but Chris Bosh is one of the best players in the league when he's healthy. Of course, he has.
He's a top 20 player.
Exactly. And so for a team that wasn't really deep in the first place in terms of just like assets, they had guys who really turned up, but that's a separate point, to put on the rallying that they did and to really play well in the playoffs. I think they deserve a lot of credit for that. I've gained a lot of respect for Spoelstra just with how he was able to use non-LeBron personnel this year. So yeah, I think it was impressive for them, and as we're going to talk about pretty shortly, they have an absolutely gigantic summer coming up.
Yeah, if you think about the depth that this team had, losing Bosch, losing Whiteside, to be able to compete this well. I mean, they lost their backup point guard, Bane Udrich. They traded another one away, basically, in Mario Chalmers. as well. And what they're able to get out of just minimum salary guys, rookie salary guys, I mean, Josh Richardson, Tyler Johnson was able to come back and play okay in this series. Winslow, obviously, Josh McRoberts even gave them some pretty decent minutes. He had 10 points, which was, and showed some, I think he can still be a player as a four off the bench who can give you, you know, 15 minutes. I felt like he probably could have played more, but again, struggled with injuries throughout the year. It's good to see him get healthy and also give one of his trademark hard fouls that made him so hated back in his Lakers and Indiana days before people kind of started to like him when he went to Charlotte and seemed like more of an underdog. So it's good to see that aspect come back for him. So I think, you know, this season, with all the obstacles they had to overcome, was really a triumph for the Heat. I would have loved to have seen what they could have done if they had gotten Joe Johnson, who came back to earth a little bit in this series, which was bound to happen at some point. He wasn't going to keep shooting like 60% on threes like he was for, you know, his first month as a member of the Heat. And so now we turn to the offseason, and the number one question hanging over that, of course, is can Bosch come back? And obviously, that's got to affect all of their offseason planning, right? Because, I mean, he's a great player. Are they going to bring Whiteside back? He's a free agent now. Can they just trust Bosch to be the center? Can they even trust Bosch to be the backup center as he was so effectively before he suffered a recurrence of what is reported to be that clotting issue? I don't know. I mean, what do you think? How would you handle it if you're Pat Riley and company?
You have to not only treat it like that it's completely unreliable, it's that it can change over the course of the year. I mean, the last 2 years he played reasonably well before missing everything after the All-Star break. His last game was February 9th this year, and that's hard to deal with as well because you had him anchor that second unit while also, of course, starting and finishing games, and then he was gone. And I referred when I was writing my offseason preview for the Sporting News, which is not yet out, but I've written a lot of them already. I referred to Miami's offseason as the most complicated in the league. And the reason why is because they have a limited amount of flexibility, but the money they have on their books is really challenging because Bosch is, you know, about $24 million. They can't trade him, of course, and they don't know what they have in him.
I think the way that I would handle it, let's start here. Let's start with the amount of space that they have so we can provide that context. A ton of people are free agents. There's been lots of talk about Dwayne Wade. He made $20 million this year. Whiteside, because he's only been on the team for 2 years, the most that they could pay him without having to use cap space would be basically the estimated average player salary, which is going to be about $6 million or so this year. That's not going to be enough to retain him, obviously. So they have, when you consider, you take Wade, Luol Deng, Udonis Haslem, Whiteside, and then Tyler Johnson's cap hold, you leave him on there, he'll be a restricted free agent. And then Joe Johnson, you take those guys all off the books, and they will have $38.7 million estimated in cap room, and they're going to need to split that up, in theory, between Wade, Deng, Whiteside, and then Joe Johnson if they want to bring him back as well. If you're just talking about what all those guys are worth on the open market, that is nowhere near enough money to do that.
And at least one of those guys, Hassan Whiteside, it will be very hard for him to give a substantial discount to Miami, considering he has been paid peanuts his entire NBA career. This is a guy who was a second-round pick, then signed a minimum contract with Miami, and that's basically his entire NBA career.
Yeah, we talked about how basically he had the most to lose, essentially, in terms of his future quality of life and earnings of anybody trying to play hurt in these playoffs for that exact reason. So now you get into what are some of the gymnastics that you might try. They could move Josh McRoberts. That's number one. I think with the way he played in these playoffs, he's due to make $5.7 million. I think that's actually reasonably tradable, which is good because they actually have literally no draft picks that they can trade now due to all the trades they made, not even second rounders. So I think you could just move him into somebody's cap space and he could help a team as a backup four. I think he has kind of shown that. Now, you might say, hey, he might actually be worth that to us too, but this is a team that probably thinks that they can do better both with minimum contracts and just, you know, with their general cap space with that $6 million than Josh McRoberts. I think they're probably right about that. Yeah, what were you going to say?
Well, so yeah, McRoberts is the one piece. The other the challenge with him, though, is this issue that you deal with sometimes with teams, which is that it will be possible to move him. However, if they need to move him early to clear the space for someone specific, that will be a different market. And the example I like to use with that is the Milwaukee Bucks. So the Milwaukee Bucks Bucks were engaged in this trade with the Clippers for J.J. Redick, and the Clippers needed to get out of Caron Butler's contract. And early in the summer, the Bucks are like, oh no, we're going to use that money. We're going to get somebody with that. And so that's how this kind of part of how the Suns came in the deal, because they were already discussing Jared Dudley. Eventually in the summer, so the Suns got him and actually got Eric Bledsoe for the trouble. Later that same summer, Milwaukee traded for Caron Butler. So what happens is teams start the summer optimistic and then become more pessimistic. So if Miami needs to trade in the optimistic time, it will be harder, but it should still be possible.
Yeah, and actually they might be able to. I think once the league year turns, they might be able to trade a 2022 second rounder, maybe as a sweetener to get off of Mick Roberts' salary. I think they can move him in, and if they have to throw in that, so we can assume that. So that'll get him up to another $5 million in space. So we'll call it $43.7 million. And then the cap could come in more. We're going on the projection of 92 right now. So still, with those guys, I mean, you have to imagine that Deng probably doesn't come back in that case. You're still, and then maybe you could fit in Whiteside's max would start at $21.7 million. And then maybe you say, all right, we give the rest of that to Wade, and or maybe, you know, Wade will take a little bit of a discount and we can give Joe Johnson some money and we just bring the band back and say, hey, we got to the second round. We were incredibly injured. Tyler Johnson, we can bring him back. You know, we'll just match because his cap hold is really small, so we can just match a restricted free agent contract with him, or just, you know, pay him, you know, $4 million a year or something like that, and we'll just run it back and see what happens then the next summer, especially if Wade again is going to be a free agent, if he takes a 1-year deal or something like that. So that's one option. What other options do you see for them besides that plan of just bringing everyone back? And for Whiteside, you know, you're just maxing him out for a 4-year contract worth about $92 million.
I will never write Miami completely off for an elite free agent again. So I have to mention Kevin Durant as a possibility.
Yeah, I guess so. And that, but see, that's an interesting point now, right? Number one, does Durant want to come there? If you knew for sure that Bosch would be healthy, oh yeah, he would probably come. Then you have Wade, you have Dragic. That team might not be able to stop anybody.
Be fun as hell, though.
What'd you say? Yeah, I mean, yeah, Bosch would play center, although you have to wonder with him being 32 next year, even if he is able to play, how much you really want to play him at center throughout the course of an entire season. And you definitely still, you know, you're going to need a backup plan. You're not going to have any. You're going to let Whiteside go in that scenario. That's one. The other one is the option of kind of doing some cap gymnastics of potentially questionable illegality, because what you're not allowed to do is have any agreements for contracts that are not already actually signed and put on paper. And you're not, you know, you're limited in the amount of raises that you can do. But in theory, Wade could take a very small salary. It could be even the minimum if they wanted him to. And number one, so he signs that initially. You get more space this year because now he signed for the minimum. His cap hold's going to be $30 million, so you need him to sign before you do all this other stuff. Then you sign other people, and then next year you'll still have his bird rights because he's been on the team forever. And so you take his small cap hold, do all your other business again with him counting for nothing, and then you give him some massive balloon contract, which, because the cap's going to go up again in 2017, you could potentially do. That would be illegal to have that agreement, but it also would be somewhat difficult to prove. And they wouldn't, if they did that, they wouldn't have him be the minimum. They'd probably have him be, you know, $7 million, $8 million or something like that. You know, kind of the same way as Dirk Nowitzki. Now, is Wade willing to do that? Is there enough trust between the parties? Who knows? You know, they finally paid him last year, but it looked like there might not be trust. So that is sort of but the Heat are the most famous franchise for sort of doing those kind of wink-wink deals. We assume that Beno Udrich is going to be back for the minimum next year because he just gave away $90,000 for no real reason this year to keep him out of the luxury tax.
And speaking of the luxury tax, the big downside of that Wade kind of understanding, let's say, is that it would almost assuredly lead to a massive luxury tax thing unless they were able to get out from under Chris Bosh's contract or something like that.
And yeah. Well, let's talk
wait,
about
can
how,
I make
that,
one other
how
point?
That might happen.
So this is an idea that isn't discussed enough, but is an important kind of catch-all for these kind of situations, and this is exactly what I feel is going to happen with Dirk Nowitzki, which is that when a team is using cap space to sign the guys, especially in either one of these cases, if Dirk has a low cap hold and Wade has a higher one, but it's the same basic premise, is that...
Yeah, and they could just renounce him
and
if they're going to...
That's exactly where I'm going, which is that you renounce them and you have an understanding with them to say, hey, within X range, we will pay you what is left. So maybe they say, like, hey, if we can get enough good guys that me making $5 million versus $10 million makes a difference, I'm all for it. And so you can come to that sort of an understanding because you have that level of flexibility. With Wade, they're going to basically have to renounce him or agree to a contract. And also, since there is a moratorium, sometimes that's a distinction without a difference. But since the moratorium is only 5 days, it could matter this time.
Let's get to Bosch, though. And this is now an interesting calculation for the Heat because he's going to want to come back. And let's say he kicks the blood clot issue. The doctors say he's fine. But you also know that he's had this recurrence 2 years in a row, and you have to figure at least, I'm not a doctor. You have to figure there's, a 50% chance it happens again, right? So here's how it would work to get them off his book. Let's say he never plays again, right? Because if you are deemed to not be able to play anymore, after a certain amount of time, you just come off the team's books completely. The way that works for Bosch as of right now is that he is eligible for a long-term injury exclusion, which basically a physician jointly selected by the league and the Players Association determines that he can't play anymore. He's eligible to apply for that, or the Heat are eligible to apply for that, within a year after his last game. However, so if he plays next year, that restarts that year clock again for them. The only exception is if he only plays in less than 10 games next year. If that happens, then you get to move the clock back to either a year after he played his last game, which is February 9th, or 60 days after he plays his last game in the year which he plays less than 10 games.
Whichever is later.
Whichever
is later of those two.
Right. Whichever one is later. So when once he plays game number 10 next year, that means that if he has a recurrence, you're a year from the time that he plays his last game next year. So that's how that'll work. A little bit technical, but that's something that's going to come into play here. I think that just unless you can get... Yeah, well, let me ask you this, right? Are there any free agents that could reasonably come there that you would rather pay than Hassan Whiteside, other than Kevin Durant?
Probably not.
Like who? I guess another way to ask it, who else is going to make you deviate from this plan of just kind of bringing the band back together and hoping that you can just run it back with these guys again?
Part of it is that it might not be their choice. If Hassan Whiteside wants to go somewhere else, he can.
Yeah, but if they maxed him out, I think it would be pretty unlikely that he would. And they can offer him the most money.
Sure.
Even if
they give him just, yeah, because, yeah, they can do that. And,
so, and well, and then, let me interrupt you there, too, because also another thing to remember is because they only have early bird rights on him, they do not have the fifth-year advantage, which would probably seal it for them for sure if they could offer him that. But instead, they can offer him 7.5% annual raises instead of 4.5%. That's the only difference between the contract they can offer and the contract anybody else with space can offer.
So Al Horford would definitely be a more stable option, but he's also older and more expensive because his max is higher than Hassan Whiteside's.
He's also just kind of like a worse version of Chris Bosh, too. And I guess a couple years younger. I mean, those two guys together could be pretty good. You're still, going to struggle in the defensive glass with those guys. If he's just the center, because your plan is going to be, if Bosch isn't available, now you're just going to play small the way you did this year, with either bringing back Dang or bringing back Joe Johnson, somebody who can be a combo forward. Justice Winslow can play that role too.
And you also, you have the challenge with them that it would be great to keep space, to keep powder dry for 2017, but they're in a very different situation than some of the other teams because they're actually good right now and they have Dwayne Wade, who I don't think has the patience for that.
All right, Mike Conley, they already have Dragic, so that's out. Nikola Batum, maybe? Would you rather pay Nikola Batum a 4-year max contract or Hassan Whiteside a 4-year max contract? They're both 27.
For what this team needs, I'd rather have Whiteside because Wade can handle some of that offensive load and Dragic, of course. And then you already have Justice Winslow as kind of a 4. I like that. I like a lot of things about that lineup. But then you're sitting there going, well, who's our center?
Yeah, so I guess now really that kind of puts it into stark relief is, okay, yeah, you don't want to pay Hassan Whiteside a max contract. I get that. But for what this team needs, the fact that they are familiar with him already, that they have kind of vets around who can keep him in line. And what else are you spending that money? I guess you could just bring back Dang and Wade and Joe Johnson and just forget about Whiteside and then maybe try to sign somebody else on the wing or, a Cole Aldrich type or something like that and roll with that. I find that Hassan Whiteside, love him or hate him, does give you the upside of this team to maybe be a championship contender if Bosch is back. And I don't think there's anyone else on the market other than Kevin Durant that falls into that category. Before we move on, I want to tell you about our sponsor, Betterment. You can learn more about them at betterment.com/capspace. Betterment is the largest independent automated investing service out there, and they've been featured in TechCrunch, the Wall Street Journal, and other fine news organizations, and that's because they make it easier, more straightforward, and less expensive to invest. It's built on smarter, cutting-edge technology to bring you sophisticated investing and financial advice, all at a lower cost than more traditional financial services. More than 150,000 customers choose Betterment's advanced advice algorithms and beautiful user interface to manage over $4 billion of their dollars. And this, of course, is the perfect time to get started with Betterment and saving for your retirement or other financial goals, because Dunktown listeners can get up to 6 months of no fees. Learn how at that betterment.com/capspace URL, betterment.com/capspace. Go to that URL so they know that you came from us. Investing made better. What about kind of more on the fringes? They're going to have the room exception, $2.9 million. You can offer a two-year contract starting at $2.9 million there. They might have some small amount of money left over. They have a small trade exception, $1.7 million. Are there any guys who are kind of cheaper guys that you think could help this team? And what would this team's needs be, assuming that they were able to bring back Wade, Whiteside, and one of Deng or Johnson?
You would definitely want a third point guard, a third primary ball handler, and that's even counting Tyler Johnson as a point guard, which he can kind of bounce between.
Yeah, they have a lot of these kind of combo guards who can like dribble but can't really set anyone up. And what they've been doing in the playoffs, which is great, is separating out Wade and Dragic, which they didn't do as much of in the regular season. So they can kind of stick with that and have Wade time and Dragic time. But I do think they would want to have another point guard who has some attribute other than he just gave back $90,000 to the franchise last year.
And they also, I think, would need a true power forward just to have another guy, you know, even if it's somebody who, you know, basically that they're going to have some sort of flaw. Actually, as strange as this sounds, the guy I thought of was Jarnell Stokes, who they had to let go for luxury tax reasons. But, just kind of maybe a high ceiling flyer guy, which Miami has done a great job of finding those types of players in recent years. And they've been more on the guard realm with those. But I think now they're going to have to push more at the forward spots to try to find a guy who, you know, best case scenario gets 10 to 15 minutes a game, but is probably less than that.
Yeah, they're going to need a backup center, even if they bring Whiteside back, in the event that Bosch, again, can't go, because then, you know, they don't have anybody. And maybe they could hope to get a buyout guy or something like that. I think someone who I would look at for them, they could use a lot more shooting, is Seth Curry.
I like it.
As a guy, maybe for the room exception, that he might be in their range. A guy, he's 25, can shoot, not the greatest defender, but a guy who actually showed some playmaking ability and can play off the ball next to Wade as well and space the floor. Not the guy who plays with like the greatest like force and effort in the way that Eric Spoelstra might love, but he would be someone among those backup point guards with his potential versatility to play on or off the ball that I would like for them. And, you know, he might be gettable with the room exception.
And Miami is in a spot, if they do what we're kind of expecting with the space, and no matter what, they're going to be shallow to a point, just because they, with the $40 million or so that they have to work with, just can't go that many directions. You know, there isn't a realistic way to do that, is that they are a great place for minimum salary or low salary guys, both on that kind of deal and what you call like a make good. I mean, the prototype for that is a guy we just discussed earlier, which is Bismack Biyombo. I mean, that's the dream, is to get a player who can be better than that kind of a contract. And Miami is both a desirable place to play, a nice place to build your reputation, but also they're going to have a lot of minutes if you can get a guy at the right spot. So Seth Curry is an interesting room exception guy. I think he's a nice fit, but you could also use that to maybe get somebody who, for whatever reason, is striking out a little bit on the free agent market and says, well, I could take a little bit more somewhere else, but Miami could offer me some opportunity that I think will translate into more money in 2017.
The last thing we should talk about, too, is you always got to think about, and especially in an overheated market like 2016, and especially for a team like Miami, about what your future free agent issues will look like. And for 2017, not counting anything for their free agents, so no Deng, no Whiteside, no Wade, they're slated to have about $50 million in room for 2017-18. So that's and Wade, maybe they'll have another one-year deal for him, and he'll become a free agent again, and then you'll have basically $25 million to fit in him and somebody else. But remember, all the maxes are going away. way up, too. You know, for guys, that great free agent class, all the guys who are in the 7 to 9 years experience, Steph Curry's, Russell Westbrook's, et cetera, those guys are all, Blake Griffin, those guys are all going to have a max of $30 million that year. So you're going to, it's going to buy you less, potentially, to have $25 million in space. You know, but then, again, they could theoretically move people.
Can I throw an idea, well, though? So. Yeah. We've discussed this idea broadly, but I hadn't really thought about it in this concrete terms, is that if Wade does the low money thing, Miami could be the biggest beneficiary in that term of the expanded area between the cap and the luxury tax, because it looks right now like that's going to be about $20 million for 2017-18. You know, it'll be somewhere in that range. $20 million, depending on what Wade gets in 16-17, might be about right. Like, they might be able to do this and either have a low luxury tax bill, and they definitely won't be a repeater.
All right, let's get to Golden State and Oklahoma City now. To me, the key variable in this one is the Warriors' health.
Yeah, that's certainly a fair argument. I mean, that's one of the more, kind of sadly, one of the more variable aspects of the series. I mean, I'm more interested in the basketball components of it, you know, like how they can do against the big lineups and things like that. But you're right that health is a pivotal factor.
Draymond Green sprained his ankle pretty badly. I guess he's been practicing. He's talking about not getting technicals, because he's now has 4 technicals and 7 is a suspension. Curry said that he's still feeling the knee a little bit, but he practiced without a sleeve on that right MCL. He definitely was not 100% before. I think that they are going to need him to be even better than he was those last 2 games of the Portland series, especially in the first half. And Green, especially if they're going to go with him playing center for big minutes, as I think they probably should in this series, he's got to be 100%. He can't be kind of hobbled on that ankle.
And they do not have a replacement for him. This is not a situation like Andrew Bogut, where if he's limited, they can go to Festus.
Bogut is questionable, by the way, with that groin injury.
Right, so they could go to Festus Ezeli. They can go to Spates, even for minutes, and maybe even some Varejao or McAdoo. And, of course, Draymond Green's there. But there is no one on this team who can really replicate that, particularly on the defensive end. And Iguodala is a different player. He has some similar strengths offensively, but it's not the same guy.
Ezeli missed all of the games against Oklahoma City this year. Kerr said that he would start if Bogut cannot go. I think that Ezeli is the superior option to Bogut in this series anyway, because Bogut is not as tough as Steven Adams and isn't as athletic either. I think that Steven Adams is really going to be able to out-physical him, whereas Ezeli, those are going to just be some massive rebound battles between those two guys. And Enes Kanter, too, when he's in, going up against Ezeli. Ezeli is one of the best defensive rebounders in the league. Bogut's defensive rebounding has kind of fallen off a little bit lately, especially even in that game 5 against Portland. Before he went out, he was just struggling to get his hands on balls and really grab it and soar above people the way Ezeli kind of can. Another thing to watch, though, is Kerr has had a really short leash for whatever reason on Ezeli in these playoffs. And every time he kind of fumbles the ball a couple of times, he takes him out and, you know, he's put in Varejao, he's put in Spates. Spates will be better in this series. I think him going up against Enes Kanter, he could really hurt Kanter with his shooting ability on that second unit to start the second quarter. But, I mean, I think it should be Ezeli. If Bogut can't go, it should be Ezeli and Spates, and then Draymond at center closing the half for like the last 6 minutes, if not more.
So you're saying they should not rely heavily on Anderson Varejao?
Let's move on. We've talked about him plenty. And I guess another question, too, is, I mean, Kerr knows what his best lineup is. When he was down in the series against Cleveland, he went to that lineup, the death lineup, and that was obviously awesome. And that was a Cleveland team that similarly had a bunch of size, you know, doesn't have the scoring with only James and no Irving or Love in that series. But it worked well against a huge Cleveland team that probably was maybe even, you could say, better defensively at times than this Oklahoma City team. And the other thing to keep in mind, too, Oklahoma City's defense was awesome against the Spurs, but the Warriors are going to put pressure on their decision-making and cohesiveness in a way that the Spurs never did.
And communication, I think, is the other huge aspect that the Warriors challenged, that the Spurs didn't have to as much, just with the ball and player movement that they can have, and just even on pick and rolls involving Steph Curry.
Yeah, just the fact that big guys have to sprint out to the three-point line, and you just always have to be mentally locked in on every pick and roll, every screening action involving Steph Curry and Klay Thompson. Like, you're naturally going to screw up, and Oklahoma City, at least during the regular season, had their share of those. And so we'll see. They defended at times very well against Golden State, made you kind of wonder, you know, down in the second half of the first game through really probably the first 42 minutes of the game in Oklahoma City. So I think that they are capable. Are they capable of sustaining it for 48 minutes for seven games?
One of the questions I asked in the Q&A that is up at The Athletic now, which is on the Western Conference Finals with a really nice panel, is I personally think that the defensive matchup in this series is whether they want to put Russell Westbrook on Stephen Curry and how that works, because Russ is a noted gambler and somebody who can struggle in pick and roll coverage, and that is exactly what you do not want against Stephen Curry.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's going to be a lot of Steven Adams trying to get out there and switch out something that he has done okay. And this is why Curry's health is going to be so paramount, because, I mean, even Steven Adams even said it in an interview, I think yesterday, what are you doing against Steph Curry? Make him drive, make him drive, make him drive. He repeated it over and over again. And Curry's going to need the burst to blow by these big defenders who are out there trying to run him off the three-point line. So it remains to be seen whether he can do that. And then also Draymond Green, are they doubling on the pick and roll? Then you're throwing it to Draymond Green. Is he going to have the burst to get to the basket and finish over the remaining big man? That's going to be another question.
And how will Oklahoma City handle those? Because my criticism of a lot of teams this year has been that they've treated Draymond Green in those situations as a scorer rather than a passer. And if he loses a little bit of burst, I think that leads them to the path, the opponents to the path that they should have been on the whole time, which is treating him as a passer in a way like what the Warriors did with Mason Plumlee and neutralized a lot of what he did there. And I'm excited to see whether Kerr uses something that has been really effective when it's been deployed, which is Clay and Steph Curry screening for each other and trying to get switches and in those kind of situations. And it's a little bit different with Oklahoma City because their matchups are, depending on who they have out there, it's a little bit closer. So it's not like you're baiting them into these like horrible defensive mistakes by doing that kind of a thing. Like you're getting, all of a sudden you're getting Tony Parker on Curry as opposed to Danny Green, but it's still something that every team struggles with considering how dangerous those two guys are when they get even a sliver of space.
Klay Thompson has struggled against Oklahoma City this year, got his attempts up, but wasn't making them. Deion Waiters guarded him particularly well in the first game in Oakland. Waiters does have some ability to really lock down just one guy one-on-one without having to worry about health responsibilities. That's what he's going to be asked to do against Thompson. Another thing then, when Oklahoma City has the ball, if they're going to start Robertson, are they going to put Bogut or Azili? Probably not Azili, but I think Bogut, they would have him just guard Robertson and muck everything up in the lane potentially, and then you put Barnes on Ibaka and Draymond Green guarding Steven Adams on those pick and rolls. Now you can just switch all those Adams-Westbrook pick and rolls or Ibaka-Westbrook pick and rolls, or if Durant's involved too, you can switch everything. So they could play Robertson off the floor. He did go 3 out of 5 in that last game against San Antonio. I will believe that he can continue to do that when it actually happens, especially on the road. So they play him off the floor, and then now you're in the situation where it's going to be Russ on Stephen Curry. And then I guess, are they going to go now to Durant guarding Draymond Green the way they did? Steph was actually able to beat Durant pretty well off the dribble at times. So again, the whole thing about Steph's burst off the dribble is going to come into play.
And mucking it up is more devastating against Oklahoma City than some other teams because they just don't have enough personnel. Of course, they have Durant, who's wonderful, but they don't have enough personnel who is devastating with those wide open shots. Russ is a notoriously shaky three-point shooter. Ibaka does well, but it kind of comes and goes. And Robertson, of course, opens up some opportunities, and if they went to Morrow or Waiters or somebody different, they can do that, but that has trade-offs on the other end of the floor. So will they be able to strike that balance? Because if you have, this is actually something that was a big issue early on in the Blazers series, which was when the Warriors had Draymond Green and Bogut as two separate lines of defense on a driver, Lillard couldn't get through that. It was just too much skill, too much craft. And if the Warriors can pull that off, then Curry doesn't need to play great defense on Westbrook to make it devastating.
We've talked about this many times before. Golden State has not had an answer for Kevin Durant one-on-one. Pretty much everyone has struggled. Draymond Green is probably their best guy one-on-one, but you don't want him getting in foul trouble. You want him, his intelligence, protecting the rim. You want him in there getting defensive rebounds as well against Oklahoma City. Oklahoma City, are they going to be able to go to the Cantor Adams lineup that closed a lot of the games in those Spurs series, and basically the Spurs couldn't get a defensive rebound to save their lives? Or is that they going to go super small and run that lineup off the floor? That would be certainly what I would advocate that they should do. And then Russell Westbrook has really struggled against the Warriors, really, almost as much as Durant has been really good. We've talked about how he generates a lot of shots at the rim, but is not the greatest percentage finisher. This is one of the best rim-protecting teams in the league with Golden State, with guys like Bogut, Azili, and Green there. If Westbrook misses layups and careens into the cameras, that's going to be a three going the other way.
And a big difference between the Spurs and the Warriors is that when the Warriors go small, it's a lot harder to stop them, so you don't really get the feedback loops as much if you're Oklahoma City. If you get offensive rebounds, you can do that, but that Warriors team is going to score a ton of buckets on you, which makes it a lot harder to have those kind of successful offensive runs.
They're going to try putting Steven Adams. I think that they are definitely going to stay big. I think Donovan is going to do that unless they just get completely destroyed for like two games in a row staying big. And the way they'll do that is to put Steven Adams on Iguodala or Sean Livingston, whichever of the two is in. Iguodala will probably get a steady diet of open threes. He'll make those pretty good from the corners, but sometimes he'll be off. And Livingston, it really was neutralized by that tactic because he can't really post up. He can kind of move along the baseline and try and get some dunks. And get out in transition, certainly, but that's a great tactic, putting your center on him because he can't shoot outside of 15 feet. So that's going to be, that's the number one most interesting thing in this series. What is your prediction?
I think it's going to be Warriors in six, and that, again, is acknowledging that it is rare for a road team to close out a series there, though, of course, it does happen. But I feel like it's a really close call between 5 and 7. I think 5 is a little bit too short and 7 seems a little bit too long, so I'm going to go with 6 anyway.
I'm really torn. I'm going to go, my heart says Golden State's been kind of injured. Oklahoma City was awesome. They're really, really tough to beat at home. Maybe this is going to be a really hard series. Maybe I should pick Warriors in 7. And then I look at it and I say the Golden State Warriors were 73-9 this year. And the way that the Thunder did not defend very well against Dallas. They did not defend very well over the course of the regular season. They had a great series against San Antonio, which ran a bunch of ISO stuff on them. I'm going to trust the larger sample here for both teams. I'm going to pick the Warriors in 5. So that's what I'm ultimately going to do. I don't feel great about it, but Warriors in 5.
One other aspect that I want to mention, because I think this is going to be something we talk about on tomorrow night's podcast, is there will be a lot of cross-matching in this series. And it will be a lot of asymmetric cross-matching, meaning that you're going to have guys guarding somebody who is not guarding them back. And where that is a big issue is in transition defense. Because if you're matching up with somebody who is not your cover or it's not reciprocal, that leads to communication issues. And I think that could be a potential big trouble spot for Oklahoma City.
Yeah, it's going to be feast or famine for Oklahoma City. If they can get on the offensive glass, it'll be feast. If they don't get those offensive rebounds, if Russ is going to be trying to go for offensive rebounds, which you know he will on occasion, it's going to be a bucket the other way. And I think the Warriors believe that they can win that trade-off, and we'll see whether they are correct or not. All right, anything to plug before we depart?
Yes, I have the Q&A that is coming out for The Athletic. I also am doing what's called a Behind Enemy Lines, where I ask people who know the opposing team well, so that will be Oklahoma City-centric perspective on the series. Those are both at The Athletic. And my off-season preview series for the Sporting News is going to start going in high gear, and I believe it is starting with the Boston Celtics on Monday.
All right, we'll be back with a wrap-up of tomorrow night's game and also to preview Toronto and Cleveland. Talk to you tomorrow night.